ideas and new technology are causing seismic shifts in the media industry. Where are we headed? What does it mean? Keep listening. Media strategist Gabriella Mirabelli talks with the brightest minds in entertainment and business. Meet the innovators, the risk takers, and the disruptors on the front lines of change from Hollywood, Wall Street, Silicon Valley, and beyond. The future is coming to a screen near you. Are you ready? This is the Up Next podcast with Gabriella Mirabelli.
Welcome to Up Next. I'm your host, Gabriella Mirabelli. Today, my guest is Tom Ziangas, SVP of Research at AMC Networks. He plays an integral role in the ongoing development of several popular and award-winning national cable television networks like AMC, IFC, Sundance TV, and BBC America. In his role, he identifies, secures, and analyzes all relevant research. This includes programming and ad sales, sponsorship research. His work helps the networks develop market and brand positioning and build powerful programming and scheduling strategies. Tom, thank you so much for being on the program.
Thank you.
So you were an executive at Nielsen for quite a long time. Given that, what are your current opinions on the role of Nielsen ratings in TV research? Obviously, there's still a currency for ad sales teams, but in terms of research, what do their metrics tell us and what don't they tell us?
Yeah, so what I would say, I do still believe in this day and age, Nielsen remains a very important and vital part of what we do in our media industry and specifically what we do here at AMC Networks. So Nielsen provides not just ad-supported information around C3 ratings and the performance of programs, but they do give us a lot of diagnostics around components of programming and scheduling and even marketing. So very simply, Nielsen today provides us what I would say is the best sample-based information for us to understand behaviors around the linear television world, where I do believe that they have work to do and are continuing to work on is on the digital side of measurement, and specifically the measurement around how people are consuming content outside the big screen on desktops, laptops, and mobile devices. Mm-hmm. So today, I would say Nielsen still is a very important part of what we do, but there are a lot of other resources that we utilize beyond Nielsen, and whether that is other services like Comscore or social media metrics or digital metrics through Google Analytics and anything that we get internally.
Right. It's a perfect segue into alternative metrics. And last year, AMC announced a partnership with Listen First. And I was wondering, were you involved in that partnership and creating that?
Yeah. So, you know, my role here as overseeing research is trying to understand what are the other, you know, research vendors providing and how can we take advantage of that information to gain greater insight? So we actually started working with on the social media side when it first came out about 6 or 7 years ago. There was a company called Bluefin Labs that we jumped on board with. We jumped on board with Trender, and you know, we also jumped on board with Nielsen's Social Guide. And what that gives us on the social media side, and especially with Listen First too, is I would say the qualitative part of what you get immediately around what people are talking about. So very easily we can find out the next day how many viewers tuned into a program. But what we can get is in the next hour is what are people saying about the programming? What do they like about it? Do they like the plot line? Do they not like the plot line? Do they like the character? Do they not like the character? So it really becomes an instant focus group around what people are talking about as far as our programming. And again, what are the attitudes and behaviors around that programming almost instantaneously?
Yeah. So have sort of like Parrot Analytics, which look at demand globally. Do you look at True Optic, which looks at piracy as a proxy for, you know, sometimes these closed, you know, what the competitors are doing where you don't have insight?
I would say that they are similar in some ways. They're also very unique to what they do. So Parrot Analytics and also True Optic really are focused around how people are consuming video in a, what I would say, quote unquote, BitTorrent slash piracy world. And it is just, again, another level of data that talks to, you know, how popular or not your programming would be. And again, folks at Parrot Analytics, you know, look at it from a demand perspective. But what they do is a little unique is not only are they pulling information publicly around how people are consuming and watching content. Again, I hate the word pirated. I guess that's what it really is. But how they're watching that content. So they have that part of it. But they're also looking at things that go even beyond that. They are looking at certain social metrics as to where people are then going on, you know, Wikipedia, what people are talking about.
Right.
And groups. So they bring that aspect on the Parrot side, which is a little different, that kind of melds some of this information together. I think that's one of the differentiating factors that Parrot does. And I've met with their founder, Warid, who is really just a really bright guy. And I think what he has is a very unique proposition. And while we are not currently subscribing to that service, we have done some custom work with them to best understand if, in fact, a program may be on the decline. Are we also seeing that decline on the demand portion of it? Or is it that there may be a higher demand? So are people now going through that distribution mode as far as getting content as opposed to going through some traditional means?
Right.
Again, so this is what I would say to you. Right now as a research department, I love the fact that there are all these different myriads of touch points around what the viewer is doing. But to be honest with you, I probably have more data than I know what I can do.
Yeah.
And really what you need from there is, and I've said this too, you know, you still need the people who are behind the screens here. And these are my analysts, my senior analysts, my managers and directors to really put in, take that translation factor and make it actionable. So as much data that's out there, you still need a lot of human beings to look at this information and kind of look at it contextually to make it actionable.
That's so true. It's funny. I was talking to a woman who's part of the IBM Genius Watson team, and we were talking about trends and big data. And she said, you know, it's really not about the big data. That'll all be eventually AI. It's about the small data. It's about the so what. And I thought, oh, yeah, because you can drown in it. There's so much. But I am interested looking at how you monitor the social activity, because you guys, you were a pioneer in using social media to interact with your fan base. And you joined AMC in 2009, right as Breaking Bad was starting to blow up and right before The Walking Dead launched. Yeah. How did your research team approach social then, and how has it shifted? How have you changed your approach?
We were pretty early adopters of the utilization of social. What did we do to best understand and work with the marketing folks about this is we took a lot of Nielsen data and we did a lot of segmentation around that data. Mm-hmm. Also, one of the first media groups to subscribe to Nielsen MRI Fusion. And what that really is it's taking the best of viewing data from Nielsen and the best of attitudinal, behavioral, and consumption data from MRI, and really looked at that information to understand who the viewer is and what they do. So if, in fact, you know, a viewer of, you know, The Walking Dead, obviously, likes to watch, you know, certain programs, likes to read these magazines, likes to go to these websites, you're getting a 360 view of who that fan is, who that Uber fan is, and who maybe the casual viewer of that program is. And from there, you can kind of then segment and say to yourselves, these are the 3, 4, 5 different segmentations of a program, and these are their likes and dislikes. This is where they may live geographically. This is where their income, what their income may be. This is what they like to do as far as travel or what kind of music they may listen to. Once you then get that kind of profile, it makes it a lot easier for the marketing team then to put a plan together to try and reach those segments. So part of it too is, again, layering in some of the social information too around this. But ultimately, what you do is, instead of you just looking at an adult 18 to 49, you're really that now taking that in a much more granular fashion to understand what component of an adult 18 to 49 they are. Are they on the lower age spectrum and in between on the older side? Initially, we thought about those folks as being fanboys, and we did a really good job, I think, reaching out to those folks to watch the programming in the last 4 or 5 years. That the average age for that program has probably increased 6 or 7 years. And I don't think that's because of us not reaching those viewers. I think we reach those viewers. I think a lot of word of mouth, whether through social or other forums, about how good the programming was, kind of filtered down to older folks who just thought it was this gory program around, you know, zombies. And what it really was is, you know, completely the opposite. While zombies were a part of this, it really wasn't about human survival and, you know, human interaction and, you know, understanding, you know, how different people interact with each other through an apocalypse.
Right. How do you use the lessons that you've learned in some of these other programs, when you have an absolutely new property and you don't have the existing, you know, track record, do you approach it differently in terms of how you're priming the pump through social? Are you pushing through social first? Are you still really pushing through linear? And how does your research department work with marketing on that discovery piece? Because as we're having this explosion in content and where content is viewable, how are you informing people so that they can discover your program? And then are you still trying to really drive tune into linear, or do you not care where they watch it as long as they're watching it and identify it with you?
Yes. So if there are new programs, a lot of times what we will do is use existing information as a proxy for those programs. So if in fact we had a program like The Night Manager, there are other, what I would say, British spy-oriented dramas that you can use in some way, shape, or form as a proxy for it. You know, programs that may air on BBC America. Some of those things might have aired in the UK 3 to 4 months earlier. So we work with our partners in the UK to kind of understand who those audiences are. There are ways of us being able to utilize proxies on new programs and best understand what those profiles are. In regard to how do we go about to plan and market to those folks, or where it just might have been, yep, we're just going to promote the hell out of this stuff on our linear channel, you know, put, you know, billboards up around the program on buses and buildings, and probably use, you know, radio in the top 25 DMAs. There's just so much more at our disposal as far as how we can reach these audience in a much more broader and targeted way. So where there might have been 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 platforms to promote to and market to our audiences, it's probably about 20 to 30 to 40 different platforms that we do that, whether it's digitally, whether it's through VOD, whether it's, you know, through social, whether it's through certain websites. We basically want to cast a wide net, very targeted as to who we're trying to reach on these different platforms.
I'm also interested in terms of sort of best practice, in terms of smartest use of research.
The coordination between us and marketing or any of the groups over here, I think they look to us to basically understand, is the methodology valid? Is what they're doing, is what these research companies say they're doing, are they doing it? And I think they look to us to basically vet that first, right?
So, right.
In fact, we give our stamp of approval and saying, yep, you know, vendor X is saying what they're doing. We went over everything around their methodology. This is what we questioned them on. We feel very comfortable in regard to their methodology. They do not want to get into that level of detail. I think the other part of it too is we are stretched extremely thin. Part of what we do with all of our research partners and vendors is have them be in some way, shape, or form an extension of us, right?
You know, right.
They will be consulting with our marketing people in addition to us as far as being in that room. They will be looked at, again, the experts in their space there. So, you know, for a company that's pretty mid-sized compared to the other media, companies there, you know, our research team is basically 28 people strong across 5 networks that basically deal with every aspect of research. So,
oh my goodness.
So I think I have the leanest, meanest team in the and I value everyone's, work and insights that they provide. While we are 28 people, we probably act like double the size as far as a research team here.
So you're able to scale through these partnerships and relationships that you have. Well, that's very, it's interesting because as an organization, that's a way you can keep your overhead down and be lean and be flexible and nimble. I'm curious also about Netflix, which is the sort of the black box. I always, they're notoriously guarded about data. Do you get any data out of Netflix? Because I know that Breaking Bad was one of the first series that people binged on Netflix. And so I'm wondering, do they communicate or is it still very black box even though you help them?
No, they do. They do communicate. I would say it's extremely limited in comparison to the level of granularity that we get from Nielsen and other folks that provide us with data. It's primarily on a quarterly basis, and it's maybe 2 or 3 metrics as far as views and time spent. And everything is specific around your own content. So the only thing that you can contextualize is against your own content. I don't know how well.
So you don't even know performance against genre. They don't even sort of. Anonymize it.
So just to make you aware of this, the folks at Nielsen have been working on a syndicated SVOD service, right? What Nielsen is doing there is that they're going to be utilizing, for the most part, audio library signatures for content that's on Netflix, and they will be able to attribute and credit viewing that would be Netflix based. So they are in by the end of this year, they're going to be able to provide what the quote unquote ratings and audience is to a Netflix original versus an AMC original versus an FX original. So that will give us, I would say, a good way of looking at and contextualizing the amount of viewing that's going on there. And I've done a bunch of things too where I've estimated, if I were to compare Netflix to other sources and channels right now, I think Netflix as a whole, I'm not talking about individual programs, but how people are consuming it, acts very much like a broadcast network as far as the amount of eyeballs it probably drives. So that to me is significant when you think about it, right? Five or 6 years ago, Netflix was still a DVD delivery service. And then all of a sudden, boom, here you are with almost 60 million subscribers and they act like a broadcast network. That means, viewing is being siphoned out of what our traditional linear ecosystem was, to an SVOD provider. And I would say that they are significantly higher than what Hulu and Amazon are, but you just have to keep an eye on those folks too.
Well, what's interesting is we just in June did a study and looked at young millennial brand ability to recognize different brands. We compared broadcasters with certain over-the-top services and Netflix blew everybody else away. And you're right, because Amazon and Hulu were scraping at the bottom. And it's interesting because, given the various ambitions in the market, you've got to do better than that with, when you think about brand recognition, the ability to use that to discover new programming and to be a destination, really. One of the other, Netflix is a big disruptor, but also, Facebook. A lot has been talked around Facebook as sort of becoming the pipes, becoming the discovery mechanism. And I read a statistic, which let me pull it up here. It was that according to Morgan Stanley, 85 cents on each incremental dollar spent digitally goes to Google and Facebook.
Correct. Yep.
Which I thought, wow, that's crazy. I mean, it makes it so competitive. And again, sort of like Netflix, it's this other, you know, do you know what's being viewed? Do you know, I mean, are you looking to monetize things through, you know, is it just promoting through Netflix or not Netflix? I mean, Facebook, sorry, I'm confusing my terms. And how are you getting information out of them about how things are performing?
Yeah, you know, so this is what I would say about Facebook and Google. So again, in the scheme of things, that is a big number, but just remember one thing, that search and display still is significantly the way that these folks are getting their revenue. So, you know, still to this day, the video portion of what goes on those big digital conglomerates is still coming from, you know, search and display.
Oh.
I do believe that, you know, video is really the next frontier, and everything that, you know, Google is doing with their YouTube and their YouTube, you know, virtual MVP service.
Right.
I think is, you know, really going to try to, in some way, shape, or form, attack that 65 to 70 billion ad revenue market that, you know, media companies still have and will continue to have until some level of viewers shift to that video marketplace here. So again, how do I use Facebook? I use Facebook in some way, shape, or form. As you know, for when I in the morning I used to go and buy my newspaper, I'll use, you know, Facebook in some way, shape, or form as gathering news from my friends and family that they believe is newsworthy. And with the political climate today, there's a lot of news around that stuff, right?
Right.
And then I would just say, too, again, I still traditionally look at Facebook as being to keep more in touch with people I care about and understand what they want to share with me. And the video content that you're watching for the most part there are clips and very short pieces of content. Now, what Facebook has is this tremendous subscriber number, and I do believe that being the base gives them a large opportunity to get involved in more long-form programming and a way of how people access premium content. I think, you know, a lot of media folks where Facebook wants their content are very leery of the control of that content and the control of the revenue around that content. So I think it's really interesting. I think it's something as an industry we need to keep an eye on and be very cognizant of, you know, a quote unquote frenemy there.
Yeah.
So, and the same thing too with Netflix. Let's just be very honest, right? Netflix was really built on the backs of a lot of our programming, right?
Absolutely.
And so I'm just trying to figure now, if we know now what we didn't know then, would we do the same thing? I don't know. I think what may have happened there is, you know, those media companies who started Hulu, maybe it would have been smarter that, you know, not just three or four media companies, get the whole industry behind it and have it as a way of, you know, you combating a competitor in the space that we control.
Right. Right. Well, I mean, sort of 2020 hindsight, I guess that's sort of moving into future predictions. And I saw a blog post from May of this year. I'm going to quote you. The fact of the matter is that viewers use the TV screen for the bulk of their viewing and spend more time doing so than all the other platforms combined. Mm-hmm. Sure, viewers have more options today, but when looking at platforms in a competitive fashion, it's clear that consumers choose the television as the primary vehicle for content. And I guess I'm curious if that's the population as a whole, and if we then look at how people are aging or how behaviors are shifting, if you would revise or tweak or change anything in that statement.
Yeah, you know, I was looking at it as a whole, as an overall P2 plus number. Yes, those numbers are different when you're looking at it by demographic. I understand that. But even when you're looking at 18 to 34, still a majority of their entertainment is going through the big screen, albeit not as large as what it may be for 18 to 49s and 25 to 54s. So I would revise that based upon the demographics that you're looking at. But again, And again, I want to make sure I'm clear about this too, is this is what I believe, right? I believe, you know, I have a 23-year-old and a 17-year-old, and outside of either live sports or very specific type of programming, they don't do a lot of watching on the big screen. They'll watch things on their laptop or their portable devices.
Right.
But still today, if in fact they want to sit down and watch a movie, they're going to do it on my 55-inch screen television and not on their, you know, smaller device. Ultimately, everything is going to gravitate towards the big screen no matter what, right? And what I mean by that is, again, initially Netflix was something that was on a desktop and a laptop. Same thing with Hulu too. And what you see now is where 7 or 8 years ago, a majority of their viewing were coming from desktops and laptops. The majority of the viewing now is coming through the big screen. You know, people are watching Hulu through their big screen. I watch Netflix through my big screen. So what I just want to make sure what you understand and what other folks are understanding is things are going to ultimately, as you age out of what your preferential device will be, to the big screen. But the difference is, where today I may go to ESPN first and AMC and BBCA, my son may be going to Netflix first and watching content, and then maybe gravitating to, if he does have a skinny bundle cable package, to watch that type of content. So in the end, this is no different when I started in this business in 1986, right? You had basically four broadcast networks that basically made up 95% of all viewing, right? Mm. And then this little thing came along called cable television. And from that perspective, the broadcast network said, these guys are getting, you know, these really small numbers. There's nothing to worry about. But lo and behold, 30 plus years come around and ad-supported cable is probably getting around 60 to 65% of share of viewing, whereas broadcast is getting 35%.
Right.
Now let's just look at ABC didn't go under, CBS didn't go under, Fox didn't go under. I think they're still as strong or stronger than they were before in a very fragmented world. What they do have still is, you know, people still watch those networks to a higher degree than other networks. So they're still viable and they're still, you know, as long as you pump out premium, good content, you'll be, you know, still in this ecosystem.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, is it the program? Is it the network? Who are people following? And then also when we think about the future of TV and sort of the earlier conversation we were having, it's almost like two questions. One is the size of the screen you're looking at as sort of one question. Are people going to be purchasing these TVs? What do the numbers look like? And then another is, what's the method of consumption? Is it linear? Is it nonlinear? I mean, do you believe that linear TV is going to go away, or it's going to reduce in, you know, 5-10 years? Or do you think it's always going to be around?
Look, I think in whatever iteration, it's going to be around. I like looking at history to help determine what will be happening in the future. Cable systems in the 90s started opening up, you know, channels. So what did that do? All of a sudden, it made a bunch of cable networks start to come up with channels so they can fill in those spaces through their, you know, MSO or, you know, cable distribution partner there. So I do believe in some way, shape, or form, the actual distribution mode kind of points to what's going to happen. So whether it's going to happen through what's being made available today, whether it's through IP and things of that nature, I do believe that, you know, some of the broadcast networks, some of your very premium entertainment networks that are on cable are still going to be viable 5, 10, 15, 20 years from now. Now, will it be the same way that I'm doing it today? Maybe not. But right, as long as you are producing quality and premium content, you're able to market and provide folks a way of accessing that content. Again, it may not be that, you know, I'm delivering a million audience in prime time. It may be 500,000, but that 500,000 may still be a significant number where everything else is fragmented.
Right. Right.
So I would say the best practice in this day and age is to continue to educate yourself about what's going on in this business. What I instituted with my folks too is when I first came here, we kind of segregated the linear portion of research. As things came very much more video centric, I made each of my network teams, not only were they going to be responsible for the linear portion of that network, and the reason why that was so important, because it just brought in all the money, right? It really did, you know, from a sales perspective. But they were responsible for every component digitally around that programming and the network too. So they then understood the interaction and the behaviors around our content, around the different ways of how people can consume it. So that's one thing that we did. So we didn't silo the TV and the digital. We brought that together to the research groups, and it needed to be education. There needed to be what I would say is understanding of different metrics and how we compare them. There was also a way of taking metrics and really converting them to common metrics, so we can better understand the relationship between a linear television and how people were consuming, whether it was through our app, whether it was through our browser, whether it was through our .com site, whatever it may be. So that's one thing that we did, is be a lot more holistic around research. And it's not an easy thing to do. You know, I would say this, television research is pretty simple. When you start going into things on a digital nature, it becomes really, really complicated. You have different metrics. You have different ways of it being distributed. It is much more complex. And I've actually brought in experts in this field over this past summer to further educate us on everything from advanced targets and how that's being used in television today and how we're using that, because that's what the digital folks are doing. Integrating this amongst the teams, I think it made us a lot smarter and a lot more understanding around the behaviors between traditional linear and digital.
Are you also, is part of what you're doing, a future proofing, for lack of a better term, do you study things which you aren't currently doing yet, or do sort of searches of research that other people have done around things like what's the impact, you know, what should the networks be thinking about voice, or what should the networks be thinking about blockchain? How much is that part of your mission, or is that something that somebody tasks you with?
Yeah, you know what? So the only thing that I could just say, there's just so much bandwidth we can kind of operate with. And what I say to my folks too, is as we kind of go through this, is, and we're establishing it right now, is establishing within our own department things like you made mention of, whether it is voice, whether it is things like blockchain, creating subject matter experts around some of these things that are going to be touching us. Part of it is keeping on top of things, always educating ourselves. My mission in 2017 was to have a formal training around what's going on in this industry. And I think I will continue to do that as long as I'm here, because you just can't learn and grasp all of these things yourself. We're establishing people on our team that are becoming subject matter experts on a lot of these components around our industry.
Right, of course. Well, thank you so much. We've reached the end of the interview. I really appreciate that you joined me today. I'd like to close by thanking a few important people who helped bring the program to life. First, my friend, Rob Naughton, the amazing voice artist who recorded our open. And of course, thanks to my production team over at Microfame Media. And a big thank you to our guest, Tom Ziangas. And of course, most importantly, all of you, the members of our amazing audience, thank you. I'll be talking to you again next week, right here on Up Next.